Well, good evening and welcome to the second Patrick Gillam lecture, and given by Jomo Sundaram. But before I introduce Jomo, perhaps I should just say a word or two about the Patrick Gillam lecture series and the connection between the school and both Pat Gillam and Standard Chartered. Pat was, you can't say was an alumnus, because that implies you're dead, is an alumnus, and he is definitely still with us, and was for many years in BP, and then became chairman of Standard Chartered, a job he did with great distinction for some time. And when he left the bank to commemorate his time with it, the bank decided to fund a chair at the school, which is held by John Seidel, who came to us from SOAS, a new chair, and also alongside that to fund a lecture series which allows us to bring to the school distinguished scholars from elsewhere who are working on issues which are relevant to the interests of the areas in which Standard Chartered is particularly active. Because as some of you will know, some of you may not know, Standard Chartered, though a British bank, and indeed one which in my previous job running the Financial Services Authority I used to regulate rather carefully, but although it is a British bank, in fact almost all of its operations are overseas, and particularly in Asia and in Africa. In fact, it's in about 50 countries with about 40,000 employees. So it's a very large bank, much larger than you would think if you live in London, because you don't find Standard Chartered branches on street corners here. But of course you do in many parts of Asia, and of course in Hong Kong, Standard Chartered issues banknotes, and I think they're going to be handing some out later on. The current chairman, Brian Sanderson, who is also with us this evening, is also an LSE alumnus. There's obviously a mafia going on at Standard Chartered, which may encourage some of you to think that it might not be a bad place to apply for a job, since they seem to be biased somewhat in favour of employing people from the LSE. But we at the school are delighted by this partnership, because it reflects our own interests. It reflects many of our students, of course, come from areas in which Standard Chartered is active, and it's allowed us to expand our interests in the political economy of Asia in particular. Now, last year, the first Pat Gillam lecture, we heard all about famine in North Korea, which was absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure tonight's lecture is going to be just as interesting. And we're delighted to have Professor Jomo Kwame Sundaram, but I'm told is known mainly as Jomo KS, according to John, who has been the Assistant Secretary General for Economic Development at the UN since the beginning of this year. He was brought up in Penang, in Malaysia, graduate of both Yale and Harvard, which shows Catholic tastes, and taught at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur, and has been a visiting professor at Cambridge, Cornell, and many other places. And he's known as one of the world's leading authorities on the political economy of Southeast Asia and East Asia more broadly, author of no less than 35 monographs, and has edited no less than 50 books, which seems an extraordinary number, and many articles in scholarly journals and other volumes, and is about to publish a book called The Long 20th Century Globalization Under Hegemony, which sounds fascinating. But tonight he's going to talk to us about whither the East Asian flying geese, the prospects for regional integration in East Asia, and I ask you to welcome Jomo Sundaram to the school.
Thank you very much, Director of the London School of Economics, Howard Davis, for those very kind words of introduction. It's a great honor for me to be here this evening, and I'm particularly appreciative to Sir Patrick Gillam and the Standard Chartered Bank for making this opportunity possible. What I would like to do over the next 45 minutes or so is to discuss some of the developments which have taken place in the East Asian region, which I expect will move towards a new type of regional economic cooperation, perhaps unlike regional economic cooperation which has taken place elsewhere. It is often presumed that regional economic cooperation will begin with some kind of preferential trade arrangement among constituent countries and will lead to other types of economic cooperation. I would like to suggest that the circumstances in the region, especially the recent circumstances in the region, will lead in a rather different direction, and that we will probably see far greater regional financial cooperation in this region rather than trade cooperation as such. But that's getting a little ahead of the story. For those of you who are students here, many of you might not remember a time not too long ago for the rest of us when one talked of the Japanese economic miracle. During the 1980s, there was a great deal of talk of the Japanese economic miracle. There were various attempts to try to understand the secret of the Japanese economic miracle. There was much speculation, both in the media as well as elsewhere, about Japan incorporated this special relationship between government and private capital. There was also a great deal of talk, contributed significantly by Professor Morishima, who was with the LSE at that time, about the confusion essence of the Japanese economic miracle. Across the Atlantic, professors would write books about Japan as number one, and also other type about head-to-head, the real threat to American leadership in the world economy would come from Japan. All this seems rather distant today, as in the first decade of the 21st century, after more than 15 years of rather moribund economic performance on Japan's part, although there continues to be a recognition of the dynamism of East Asia more generally. And there has been for quite some time now comparable recognition of what has been referred to as the East Asian miracle. Sir Ian Little at Oxford and a couple of his colleagues, Tibor Skitowski and Maurice Scott, wrote 3.5 decades ago about the East Asian region, mainly referring to what I would term Northeast Asia, Japan, the Republic of Korea, South Korea, and Taiwan province, or the Republic of China, as it calls itself. And this region was characterized as one which had achieved rapid economic growth, particularly from the 1960s, due to adoption of policies of economic liberalization, particularly of trade liberalization. Unfortunately, this claim was not subjected to careful critical scrutiny, and one would not have guessed from reading their book that the effective rates of protection in these economies were actually higher than in any of the economies in Latin America. But nonetheless, this view certainly prevailed and was dominant for well over 2 decades. From around the 1980s, at a time when Japanese miracle was ascendant, so to speak, there was new talk of a so-called flying geese model. Okita Saburo, the then foreign minister of Japan, was particularly influential in promoting this view of flying geese, where Japan served as the lead goose, not unlike Britain during the Industrial Revolution at the beginning of the 19th century, and subsequently the United States in much of the 20th century. And within this East Asian region, it was suggested that Japan was playing the role of the lead goose, and the other economies, which were growing rapidly at that point, were, in a sense, part of this flying geese formation, flying rapidly, partly because they were in the slipstream of the lead goose, Japan. This image was a very influential image in much of the world, and led to a great deal of speculation about where this Flangeis formation was leading, the likelihood of the emergence of a possible Yen block, and much was written in that vein. From the early 1980s, academic revisionism, pioneered by an American professor, Chalmers Johnson, led to increasing attention to what he termed the developmental state. And Professor Johnson focused particularly on the role of the Ministry of International Trade and Industry and its role in creating new types of economic activities, particularly industrial activities in which Japan had become eminent, and the crucial and hence suggested that government intervention and government leadership, particularly in this area, had been very important. This was reflected in other parts of the world. Some of you may remember Michael Heseltine offering a different view of what a Tory government might offer to British industry in this country. Now, following from that work, we find that there were others, particularly in this country, people like the late Gordon White at the Institute of Development Studies, Alice Amsden at that time at MIT, and Robert Wade, who subsequently joined the LSE, who wrote variously about Korea, Taiwan, and other parts of East Asia, and suggested that this role of a developmental state was not peculiar or unique to Japan, but rather was a phenomenon which was more general to that region. Now, beginning from the second half of the 1980s, the relationship between Japan and much of the rest of the world, particularly the industrialized economies, began to change rather significantly. And some of you may well remember that in 1985, in September 1985, at the second G5 meeting held at the Plaza Hotel, or the erstwhile Plaza Hotel, for those of you who are New Yorkers in the audience, at the Plaza Hotel, there was a deal made basically between the United States and Japan, and secondarily Germany, to allow the dollar to depreciate, to allow the U.S. to, in a sense, depreciate its way out of its problems. I mention this particularly because in many ways the current approach of the second Bush administration in dealing with its relations, particularly with the People's Republic of China, has echoes of this previous period. And in turn, both these episodes, Plaza as well as the current period, echo the initiative of the Nixon administration when it unilaterally broke with the Bretton Woods system in 1971. Now, appreciation of the Japanese yen, referred to in Japanese by the term endaka, one began to see a changed situation, particularly among the dominant economies of the world. Japan was not only number two following the United States, but emerged as the single largest contributor of ODA, or Official Development Assistance. And this allowed Japan to develop a certain leverage, if you will, in international institutions, which it never previously enjoyed. And particularly in the World Bank, where it was the single largest contributor, the executive director of the World Bank, Mr. Shiratori, insisted that the World Bank might reconsider some of the policy advocacy and the policy conditionalities it was associated with, particularly in relation to Latin America and to Africa, where it was associated with what have been termed structural adjustment programs. Mr. Shiratori offered on behalf of the Finance Ministry of the Japanese government to fund a series of research projects, beginning with a study of the East Asian miracle, and this volume was to appear in September 1993. Very importantly, the East Asian miracle volume departed significantly from the official position of the bank at that time, which has been summarized variously by John Williamson, among other people, as the Washington Consensus, reflecting a view shared by the Bretton Woods institutions, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank on the one hand, and the US Treasury Department on the other. This shared view, this so-called Washington consensus, basically favored drastic economic liberalization on a number of fronts, not only to bring about, to stabilize macroeconomic imbalances, but also to bring about the necessary changes in economic structures of nations, which would allow them to more fully integrate into global or international markets. And it was suggested that this type of greater integration of national economies into world markets would basically have benign consequences for growth and economic development. The 1993 volume suggested that the world was actually slightly more complicated than that and suggested a role for government. And this role for government was justified principally in terms of what are called market failure arguments. It was suggested that the East Asian governments had basically been able to grow rapidly precisely because East Asian governments had undertaken what were called functional interventions which addressed market failures, and by so doing created the conditions for rapid economic growth in that part of the world. In contrast, the bank suggested that the same East Asian governments had undertaken what they described as strategic interventions. And the claim was that these strategic interventions were basically misguided and had basically failed. It was suggested that as far as in industrial policy is concerned, or selective promotion of new types of economic activities, particularly in manufacturing, the record was dismal. It was also claimed that trade policy interventions had by and large failed. The exception to this argument, however, was in a remarkable chapter pseudonymously authored by Joseph Stiglitz, who subsequently went on to win the Nobel Prize, but before that became the senior vice president and chief economist of the bank during the second Clinton administration. So with this exceptional chapter where Stiglitz insisted that government interventions in East Asia, particularly in the area of finance, had made it possible for new economic activities, particularly in manufacturing, to more easily access financial resources and thus begin the whole process of investment and growth, the rest of the story of government interventions of a strategic type was basically one of failure. Now, in working at that time from Southeast Asia, some colleagues and I dissented from this very influential position, while commending the World Bank for taking a view which had departed from the prevailing, from the earlier orthodoxy associated with Little, Skidowski, and Scott. We were of the view that the bank had wrongly hyped up the image of Southeast Asia. It had suggested that Northeast Asia, referring to Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, were so exceptional that they were not serious candidates for emulation. And instead, the rest of the world, particularly Africa, but much of the rest of the developing world, should look towards Southeast Asia for inspiration and as a model for development. We pointed out that the growth performance of Southeast Asia, while impressive, was actually significantly more modest than in Northeast Asia. Not only was growth on average 2 percentage points lower, but the higher population growth of Southeast Asia meant that on a per capita basis, the average difference was about 3 percentage points. And over an extended period of about 2.5 to 3 decades, this 3 percentage point difference really did count for a great deal. We also pointed out to other differences, which I shall come back to in a minute. Now, this situation which existed by the early 90s was beginning to change almost at the moment that Japan was able to influence the development discourse by sponsoring this very influential study. The discourse itself was beginning to change, not least because Japan's preeminent position was beginning to fade very dramatically following its own financial big bang beginning from 1989. This combined with the high yen imposed since the second Plaza meeting of September 1985 began to unravel the basis of the Japanese economic miracle in very profound ways. And with the emergence of China, the rapid economic growth of China following under the leadership of Deng Xiaoping at that time, one began to see that the leadership of Japan vis-a-vis the East Asian region became increasingly subjected to question. This was perhaps most dramatic in terms of the interpretation of the history of the region, particularly the history of the region during the Pacific War, the Second World War, but also it involved a great number of other issues, although those other issues perhaps did not receive the kind of international attention which the interpretation of the war and the memory of the war played in the region. Now, unfortunately, despite the consequences of the Big Bang for Japan, the East Asian region did not draw the lessons which it might have drawn from a more careful and critical examination of the Japanese experience and the consequences of the Big Bang. After all, Japan was not the only economy which went into a tailspin following shock treatment. The same thing was happening, as you may remember, in parts of Eastern Europe, as was the case in parts of Latin America as well. Now, this push for what might be termed international financial liberalization had very important consequences for the region. And if one makes some kind of a comparative analysis of the consequences of international financial liberalization in developing countries, or what were then beginning to be known as emerging markets, one begins to see that that the consequences of international financial liberalization for development, for economic development, are really quite mixed. In many instances, the availability of new funds, usually on a short-term basis, contributed to asset price bubbles, most importantly in stock markets, but also very often in real property markets. Secondly, one found that in some economies, for instance, Thailand before the crisis, it financed consumer binges. The number of luxury cars in Thailand, for instance, increased astronomically, particularly during the mid-1990s. And with the benefit of hindsight, some people would argue, although I suspect the record is actually much more mixed, that there was also a great deal of overinvestment in the region. A case which is often mentioned is the tremendous investments by Korean jaibols or industrial conglomerates, as well as Taiwanese companies in the production of electronic components. The price of a DRAM unit, for instance, in the late 1980s was slightly over $80. By the mid-1990s, the price per unit had fallen to under $2. Now, one can obviously say with the benefit of hindsight this was a terrible investment to make, but I think very few people would have been able to predict the outcome of that kind of very intense competition, particularly in industries where access to industry is not limited by constraints such as patents or other strong intellectual property rights. Now, these consequences of international financial liberalization were not completely unknown, but they did not get the kind of attention from policymakers which they deserved. Instead, there was a great deal of enthusiasm. The possibilities for making a great deal of money from financial arbitrage, for instance, was considerable. And continental European banks and Japanese banks were very enthusiastic about the possibilities, particularly in Southeast Asia. American banks and British banks tended to be a little bit more reserved, especially because they had been seriously affected by the Latin American and Eastern European debt crisis of the earlier decade of the 1980s. And so they held back a little bit more. But the continental banks, the continental European banks, and the Japanese banks were less wary. Now, in 1995, in the second quarter of 1995, the Vice Minister for International Affairs of the Japanese Finance Ministry, Mr. Sakakibara, and Larry Summers, the Deputy Treasury Secretary of the United States, got together, and they basically put an end to the Endaka of the previous decade. So from September 1985 to the second quarter of 1995, you had a period of the high yen, and this was reversed basically from mid-1995. And the result of this, of course, the results of this were, of course, very serious, but unfortunately, particularly in Southeast Asia, there was a limited ability to adjust to these new circumstances. The reason I would argue, the main reason I would argue, is because in Southeast Asia, the leading role of transnational corporations, of foreign direct investment in leading the industrialization process, had compromised and weakened the emergence of a domestic or indigenous industrialist community. And the absence of a domestic industrialist community meant that the wealthy in Southeast Asia tended to gravitate around the interests of finance and saw their interests as very closely associated with finance rather than with industry. And as a consequence of that, their ability of industrialist concerns, people more associated with the real economy, to influence government policy, to try to ensure that government policy was much more sensitive to the requirements of the real economy, was simply not there. This was quite different in Southeast Asia from the situation in Northeast Asia, as where a much stronger industrialist community had emerged. So the influence of such financial interests in Southeast Asia basically meant that the governments in Southeast Asia were committed to maintaining their pegs, their currency pegs against the U.S. dollar, because a great number of them were borrowing money in U.S. dollars, albeit from European banks or from Japanese banks, but the money was essentially denominated in U.S. dollars and flowing into the region in U.S. dollars. If their currencies depreciated against the U.S. dollars, this would basically raise the level of their liabilities, and this was something they wanted desperately to avoid. So as a consequence of that, even though the appreciation of their currencies together with the U.S. dollar meant that their productive sectors and the export sectors were becoming less competitive, this situation prevailed between mid-1995 and mid-1997. Now, as you know, on the 2nd of July 1997, the Bank of Thailand floated the Thai baht. And the consequence of the floating of the Thai baht basically was that there was a great deal of panic in financial circles about the fate of the region. There was a quick rush for the door throughout the region. Short-term assets in particular were liquidated and sold. Stock markets collapsed. And the liquidity, which was so essential towards the smooth workings of the system which had emerged in Southeast Asia, basically disappeared. The main consequence of that, of course, was a contraction of the economies of the region, particularly from early 1998. But this whole problem was exacerbated by public policies. And these were public policies adopted by governments in Southeast Asia, as well as in Korea, but usually at the behest of the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund was seen as the repository of accumulated wisdom in terms of dealing with currency crisis. It had considerable experience in Latin America and elsewhere, and it was seen to be the appropriate institution to refer to in terms of dealing with this type of with this kind of problem. Unfortunately, the fund's analysis of the situation in East Asia was inappropriate. It drew wrongly analogies from Latin America to East Asia, and failed to recognize some very basic macroeconomic differences between the situation in Southeast Asia, in East Asia, and Latin America. For instance, in much of East Asia, governments did not run fiscal deficits. They in fact had handsome fiscal surpluses in most instances. But nonetheless, the prescriptions were similar. Deflationary or pro-cyclical macroeconomic policies were prescribed, involving a sharp reduction in spending on the fiscal side, as well as contraction, raising interest rates on the monetary side. The result, of course, was a sharp contraction throughout the region. Now, to be fair, the fund soon learned, well, not too soon, but by mid 1998, it realized the error of its analysis and the error of its policy prescriptions, and began to change policy very significantly on the fiscal front, encouraging governments to spend much more, to spend its way out of the problems. But as far as monetary policy was concerned, it preserved its original analysis and continued to advocate a high interest rate policy to try to reverse the situation. Now, in the meantime, the international public discourse around the situation was also changing in very significant ways. After recognizing that in the second half of 1997, that the analysis of the East Asian crisis was fundamentally erroneous, that the currency crisis theories which were being invoked were actually not relevant to the region, the public discourse in some of the most influential parts of the world changed radically in early 1998 in a series of remarkable speeches. Remarkable because they coincided so closely in time, within a space of less than 1 month. Mr. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, followed by Larry Summers, then Treasury Deputy Secretary, and Michel Camdesou, Managing Director of the IMF, spoke very gravely about the problems of corporate governance in East Asia. In other words, the whole analysis of the roots of the crisis had changed rather remarkably from one of currency crisis to a crisis of corporate governance. Now, having written very critically about the character of Southeast Asian corporations during this period, much of the work of my associates and myself were actually being invoked for the purposes of these criticisms of the Southeast Asian business scene. However, I do not subscribe to this view as much as it is associated with some of the work which we were associated with. In polite discourse, in academic discourse, the discussions, for instance, changed rather dramatically. Whereas previously one spoke of social capital and the importance of social capital in bringing about these benign outcomes in East Asia, in bringing about the miracle in East Asia, the discourse changed radically and one began to speak about cronyism instead, and how cronyism was detrimental to what was going on in East Asia. And so you found in very, very important ways the academic discourse following the policy discourse rather than leading the policy discourse as it might previously have done so. Now, as I suggested earlier, by mid-1998, there were very serious reflationary efforts undertaken in most countries of the East Asian region hit by the crisis, And these reflationary efforts mainly involved fiscal measures to try to spend more, to try to address some of the consequences of the crisis. But they were, as I suggested earlier, fettered very, very significantly by the monetary measures which were undertaken. Now, in the West, particularly in the United States, there was growing recognition that the situation in East Asia demanded international attention. It was not simply a problem of the East Asians, which were due to their own proclivities, but rather required a more concerted international response. And President Clinton, in an important speech in mid-1998, spoke for the first time in San Francisco about the need for a new international financial architecture. The following month, the crisis seemed to be spreading further, not only to Brazil and Latin America, but very, very importantly to Russia. And shortly thereafter, the crisis in Russia precipitated the collapse of long-term capital management. Now, the collapse of long-term capital management was extremely serious for a number of reasons, not least because it was a very high-profile hedge fund which seemed to have a superior model for its analysis, for its investment analysis, and because it was extremely highly leveraged. There have been different estimates about the degree of leveraging which LTCM enjoyed, and there is significance, but there's no doubt in most minds that the degree of leveraging was extremely high. For academic financial economics, this was also a great embarrassment. Only the previous year, the Nobel laureate for economics had gone to the Merton Scholes, and well, it posthumously might have gone to Mr. Black, except that the Nobel laureate doesn't go to posthumously to anybody. So the Merton Scholes model had been the basis for the operations of LTCM. So what happened with the collapse of LTCM was extremely embarrassing all around. And not surprisingly, Mr. Greenspan, as chairman of the Federal Reserve, intervened very discreetly to arrange for a private sector bailout. And this private sector bailout soon attracted a great deal of attention in East Asia, where there had been some clamoring for government interventions to try to bail out some of the most adversely affected corporations, partly because the claim was being made that these corporations were adversely affected for being in the wrong part of the world at the wrong time, rather than because of misdemeanors, let alone felonies on their own part. So the whole discourse then about the role of government and the role of government in response to financial crisis changed rather dramatically during this period. U.S. Fed Chairman Greenspan then intervened to lower interest rates in the United States, and this, perhaps more than anything else, brought an end to the East Asian crisis. Money began to flow back into the East Asian region, and by the last quarter of 1998, most of the region began to recover. Now, at around this same time, Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir had introduced capital controls on outflows. One should mention that capital controls on inflows had been introduced much earlier in 1994, temporarily introduced in early 1994, but the introduction of controls on outflows was perhaps unprecedented in recent memory, and this was an extremely controversial act, and it was timed with the sacking of his erstwhile deputy Anwar Ibrahim, and there has been a great deal of controversy over this and the relationship between the political and the monetary. Now, without going into the details of all that for the time being, I think it is important to point out that the prophets of doom who suggested that the introduction of controls on outflows would be calamitous were proved wrong. There was no Malaysia, in fact, had the second sharpest recovery, second only to Korea's recovery in the year 1999 and the year 2000. And there is little to suggest that the imposition of controls was particularly problematic for the Malaysian economy at that time or in the time following that. Nonetheless, it is also impossible for anyone to prove that it was the controls which were introduced in September 1998 which were responsible for the recovery, because as I suggested earlier, the rest of the region also recovered, and there's no, including Korea, which had not introduced any such controls. So I think the debate on this particular issue on the efficacy of controls is a matter which is still moot and subject to a great deal of debate. Now, allow me to step back a little bit and to consider what had changed, if you will. Recently, the great management guru, Peter Drucker, passed away. And some of you may remember a very influential article he published in 1986 about the changed world economy. In 1986, Drucker pointed out how the world economy had changed so significantly and how cross-border flows of funds were increasingly unconnected to the real economy. At that time, according to him, the flow of funds for speculative purposes was 11 times the flow of funds for real economic transactions. By the time of, by 1996, just before the East Asian crisis, this ratio had changed dramatically. The proportion of funds of cross-border transactions related to the real economy was less than 3%, and it has continued to decline since then. In other words, the significance of such flows, which have very little to do with the real economy, is a matter of great concern. At the same time, there is no international financial authority which supervises or oversees such flows, and this I would like to suggest is a problem which the world community needs to address. Now, let me sum up very briefly what I believe to be some of the major lessons which one might draw from the experience of the East Asian crisis. Firstly, I think the East Asian crisis clearly underscores the fact that the world economy and the world financial system is not been sufficiently organized and managed to avert crisis. There's a great deal of evidence, as Drucker predicted and as others have shown, of the increasing frequency of currency and financial crisis. But nonetheless, there's not been any corresponding response by the international community to deal with the consequences, with this increased likelihood with the increased likelihood of such crisis. Secondly, in the event of such crisis, and since the frequency of such crisis has greatly increased, there is a great deal of need for crisis management capacities to emerge. And again, unfortunately, those crisis management capacities simply do not exist. Now, that's a fairly strong assertion. One might discuss what exists in the IMF and so on and so forth, but I think most people will not disagree that the existing mechanisms of crisis management as opposed to crisis aversion are really rather skimpy. Thirdly, and it's a subject which I'll come to in the last part of my discussion, the role of the international financial system in providing effective intermediation for developmental finance has been very much neglected, with the emphasis on financial liberalization. This is a matter, I think, of great concern for those of us who are concerned about developing countries. And for instance, the British government has put a great deal of effort into the whole question of of front-loading finance to the least developed countries to be able to sort of to kick off efforts to make poverty history and so on and so forth. And so this is a matter which I think is a matter of great concern for all of us. Fourthly, I would suggest that a great deal needs to be done, as I hinted a few minutes ago, in the area of international monetary and financial governance. A long time ago, Lord Keynes talked about the need for such international monetary and financial governance, and more recently, Lord Eatwell at Queen's College in Cambridge has suggested the possibility of the emergence of a world financial authority. Previously, the United Nations has proposed something called the World Finance Organization, which might play a similar role. I'm not particularly wedded to any particular institution, but I think there is a growing felt need for greater supervision, surveillance, and regulation in this area. Fifthly, the G8 at its recent meeting at Gleneagles and under leadership of Prime Minister Blair emphasized the greater role for policy space and the need not to encumber sovereign governments, particularly in the poor countries, with policy conditionalities. And it is important in this regard that governments actually have financial authority, financial sovereignty. And in this regard, it is important to ensure this sovereignty, which is meaningful, so that monetary and financial policy can be deployed, particularly for developmental efforts. And the current tendency to emphasize central bank independence without recognizing this need is something which might be reevaluated, particularly for developing countries. Finally, and this is the subject of the last set of comments which I'm going to make, the need for regional financial cooperation is something which I think is particularly pressing and urgent, something which has not been thought about very seriously outside of Europe, but which I think we will need to begin to think about much further. And in this regard, the limited progress in East Asia is something to be studied, not with a view to emulating, but to recognizing the difficulties of organizing the necessary collective action to move forward, and not to wait for crisis to occur and simply to respond to crisis or to wait for the next crisis, so to speak. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, there's a tendency to think of regional economic cooperation primarily in terms of preferential trade areas, a common market, a customs union, and variations thereof. And this is quite understandable. There's some basis for thinking along these lines in theory. And as far as the East Asian region is concerned, there have been attempts to do so. When ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, was set up in 1967, its emphasis was importantly not on the political, but rather on the economic and the cultural. In fact, ASEAN was significant for the first quarter century of its existence precisely because of its political role. But this was certainly not its ostensible intention. Only in 1992 did the governments, leaders of ASEAN, commit themselves to creating an ASEAN free trade area. And the ASEAN free trade area has played an important role since then. But prior to that, the only cooperation was that under Japanese sponsorship, in the form of ASEAN industrial projects. And so the degree of cooperation within the ASEAN zone has actually been quite limited. Many people also take the view now that preferential trade areas are really do not contribute towards developing a much more multilateral trade system. And so, for instance, in the recent discussions about creating a free trade area in the Americas, the European views and views in other parts of the world were really quite skeptical about its contribution to the Doha round, for instance. Now, following the outbreak of the East Asian crisis in mid-1997, the Sakakibara, who was then still Vice Minister for International Affairs in the Japanese Foreign Ministry, proposed an Asian monetary facility. This did not take off, and subsequently it took off in very much more modest form about a year later, and under the rubric of the Miyazawa Initiative. It involved basically a number of complex IMF-approved bilateral currency swap facilities, which have really not been very significant in practice. Nonetheless, they have been important symbolically as suggesting the need for such cooperation and indicating the potential for such cooperation. Since 1999, the ASEAN plus three, meaning China, Japan, and Korea, have been able to get to cooperate much more. Their finance ministers meet twice a year, and since the year 2000, there has been the Chiang Mai Initiative, which has institutionalized the swaps which I referred to earlier. At the same time, there have been serious efforts to try to develop a regional bond market, which I won't go into at this point. And this year, a significant new initiative has been proposed. The response so far has been very lukewarm, and I'm not sure how far it will go, but the new initiative is to create what might be termed an Asian investment bank, comparable to the European Investment Bank. And the idea here is to mobilize private sector financial resources and not to rely on concessional financial resources provided by governments, as in the case of the ADB, or Asian Development Bank. JBIC, the Japanese Bank for International Cooperation, estimates that the needs, the financial needs to fund infrastructure in the East Asian region alone is in the region of about $200 billion a year. And less than a quarter of that is currently available through on concessional terms. So there is a great deal, there's a great role for the kind of intermediation which might be provided by an Asian investment bank facility. Now, whether or not this will come about remains to be seen. On the other hand, you have a situation where the Republic of Korea, South Korea, has joined the other East Asian five countries which have been involved in accumulating a great number of foreign exchange reserves for self-insurance purposes. As you all know, Japan, Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, and Singapore have a great deal of, hold much of the world's foreign exchange reserves between them. And Korea has joined in as well. Now, most of these economies, with the possible exception of Singapore, hold their reserves in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds. And the consequences there, therefore, are that these funds originating from the East Asian region are not recycled in the East Asian region, but instead go to support U.S. government consumption. So it is rather curious that the next U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman, Ben Bernanke, has talked about a world savings glut. I would suggest that the problem is not that of a world savings glut, or an East Asian savings glut, if you will, but rather of a failure of financial intermediation. And here I think there is an important role to be played by new initiatives, particularly from East Asia, where most of these reserves are currently held, to be able to redeploy these same reserves in ways which would make available far more resources for developmental purposes, not only within the East Asian region, but also beyond. In this way, I suspect that the East Asian region might be able to contribute to creating flying geese in the rest of the world as well. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much for that fascinating panorama, some of it of financial crises, which I personally lived through the London end of, so it sort of brought a few things back to me. We have time for some questions, and there are also stewards with microphones, which are needed, really. So, and we have microphones on the top as well. First hand I saw was that at third row from the back there, a sort of grey top. Yeah, microphone's just coming to you, and then I've got somebody in front of you. I've got you next, thanks.
Will greater Asian integration help to achieve greater Asian representation, or shall I say a fairer Asian representation at the United Nations and its agencies, particularly the IMF and the World Bank?
As you know, the governance of the Bretton Woods institutions is not on the basis of democratic governance, if you will, but rather the principles of corporate governance are perhaps more relevant there, although many people, particularly the Japanese, would dispute that even principles of corporate governance are relevant in the Bretton Woods institutions, because they are underrepresented in terms of their voting rights compared to their financial contributions. I do not expect a significant change to take place, but as you might have followed from the remarks of IMF Managing Director De Rato, some of his remarks earlier this year, particularly preceding the September meeting, suggest a greater sensitivity on the part of the IMF that they are becoming increasingly marginal to the action in East Asia. And so there is an attempt by the fund to try to re-engage East Asia. It's still not clear what these initiatives will consist of, but I think there is certainly a recognition on the part of the fund. The new president of the World Bank also suggests that a greater desire on his part to lend to middle-income countries rather than to the poorest countries. There is a mixed reaction on the part of the international community to this, because it is generally felt that lending on preferential terms should go to the poorest rather than to the middle-income countries, particularly those who would have access to funds on private on in the markets. So there is a mixed view of this, and some criticism, particularly in private financial circles, about the priorities of the new president of the bank. But as far as the whether this will significantly change what is going to happen in at the UN is concerned, although the UN works on the basis of one country, one vote, there is a mixed view as to there's a great deal of unhappiness, particularly in China and Korea, about the fact that the only candidate for a permanent seat in the Security Council, which was approved by the United States, was Japan. Germany, perhaps because it was part of old Europe, and Brazil and India did not get comparable support. And there's also growing unease among some developing country governments that the temptation of a seat in the Security Council is leading some of the bigger developing countries away from providing more effective leadership of the developing country caucus, the G77, in the United Nations. But for the time being, at least, both India and Brazil seem to be continuing to fulfill its obligations, although there is some skepticism about its ability to continue to do so as the prospects of joining of becoming a permanent member of the Security Council become more greater.
Thank you. Next one, if you could, I should have asked people to say their name and where they're from. We need to do this in case there's anyone here from HSBC, because Standard Chartered would need to know that.
Neville Grant from the United Nations Association, UK. Thank you, sir, for a very brilliant exposition. You spoke of the possibility of a world financial authority. This would obviously be pointless unless there were teeth, and I just wondered if you thought there was any mileage in something like a Tobin tax, or a two-tier tax or stamp duty, one of the functions of which would be to raise funds for development, but the second tier of which would be almost a penal or control role to stop very damaging speculation, which we saw happened in Malaysia and Thailand.
The official view of the United Nations is not to endorse this new innovations, these proposals for new financing innovations. Let me also emphasize that the likelihood that the Tobin tax would effectively avert financial crisis is now much more mixed for a number of reasons which I can't go into right now. However, one might well distinguish between the two purposes which you correctly identified: one, averting crisis, and two, raising funds. I think the desirability of raising funds, new funds for developmental purposes, is obviously there. And Professor Atkinson at Nuffield College led a project a couple of years ago, which has identified a whole range of possibilities of innovative sources of financing. In Europe, there has been almost a singular focus on the Tobin tax. As far as the Tobin tax is concerned, some of you might remember that before he passed away, Professor Tobin disavowed the Tobin tax proposals for the purposes of revenue raising. And the reason he did so was because he felt that the Tobin tax, the original intent was to, in his words, throw sand in the wheels, or rather in Keynes's words, to throw sands in the wheels to reduce the likelihood of pro-cyclical tendencies and to introduce, in a sense, counter-cyclical friction into the financial system, if you will. Now, there have been a number of other proposals which actually have revised the original Tobin proposals in terms of the feasibility of the proposals, both from the perspective of crisis aversion as well as for revenue generation. My favorite right now is to talk in terms of the Summers tax. Before Larry Summers, as you know, is now the president of Harvard University, but before he joined the World Bank as the chief economist in the early 1990s, together with his wife, he wrote a very interesting paper. I think it was published in 1989. His wife is a tax lawyer, and together they wrote a paper proposing a tax on cross-border flows, which would have essentially a similar effect to the Tobin tax proposal. Another prominent opponent before he passed away was the late Rudiger Dornbusch. And Dornbusch also opposed the original Tobin tax proposal, but also came up with an alternative of his own. So I would suggest that rather than committing ourselves to the specificities of Professor Tobin's original proposal made in the 1970s, we might well revisit the spirit and the intent as elaborated by others, including the civil society movements which have come up in recent years, and devise proposals which would be more appropriate to the times we live in, but also flexible enough to be acceptable to, because these taxes are not going to, these proposals will not be implemented unless governments see the virtue in them. And so I think there's a great deal of need to engage those involved in government decision making, those who have been involved in supervision, including our chairman tonight, for instance, in these kinds of discussions much more carefully, to be able to devise proposals which will have more traction than the original Tobin tax proposal.
Thank you. Down here, thanks.
Thank you. Good evening. Jared Lyons from Standard Chartered. You haven't mentioned the word China this evening. Regional integration anywhere needs good economics and good politics. If we were to look at this in economic terms, Asia and the world economy needs to see Asian domestic demand stronger, which needs deeper Asian financial markets, which basically needs Asian central banks to put more of their reserves in Asian currencies, not in dollars. But for that to happen, the Americans wouldn't be too pleased, and it needs clear political leadership in the region, hence China's importance. Also, you mentioned Morris or Chalmers Johnson at the start. I believe he was the U.S. ambassador to Japan. But last stuff I've read of his, he was very much highlighting some time ago the growing importance of U.S.-Japanese relations. And it's quite clear that whilst U.S.-Japanese relations are probably at an all-time high, it's difficult to tell in terms of Chinese-U.S. relations where they will go in the future. But when one looks at regional integration, for it to be successful, needs good economics, good politics, and China therefore has to play a central role in terms of future Asian integration. Where do you see China playing out in all of this?
China has been very careful in its relations with Southeast Asia. There was a Singapore proposal, for instance, to have a free trade agreement between China and Singapore. The Chinese politely declined that offer, holding out instead for such an agreement with all of ASEAN. That has not materialized yet. I think the Chinese recognize that for them to be an effective leader in the region, they will have to be sensitive to the broad variety of interests and the diversity of interests in this East Asian region, rather than just deal with the with specific interest groups. Now, as far as trade is concerned, I think the Chinese are quite aware that they have been responsible for some degree of deindustrialization, not only in the rest of the world but also in Southeast Asia, and so there's a great deal of hesitance on the Chinese part in terms of how they proceed as far as trade liberalization is concerned. As far as finance is concerned, given the effective peg which the Chinese have with against the US dollar, which ironically the US has an interest in preserving. The US has always been ambiguous about this, and if you might remember, not the recent visit of Mr. Snow, but the previous visit of Mr. Snow, when he came back seemingly empty-handed after he had been reminded of the full consequences of Chinese abandoning US Treasury bonds for European assets, for instance. And this, of course, had very important implications. So it's very difficult to predict the likely leadership role of China and the role it will play. I suspect that that they will continue to be sensitive to the other economies in the region. On the one hand, but they will also not want to antagonize the United States leadership on the other. And these two constraints will significantly affect the range of options which the Chinese leadership will be able to consider. One must also remember that a great deal of, you know, China's seemingly attracts 70% of the FDI in going to East Asia, but a significant proportion of that is what is called round-trip FDI, funds which leave China and then come back as foreign direct investment. And this is part of the problem for here, of course, is the whole question of property rights in an economy which is ostensibly under Communist Party leadership, and where property rights are much more ambiguous than might be the case elsewhere. So you have a number of complications in the Chinese case. Not least of which, of course, is the fact that the financial institutions have been reformed very, very significantly in the last few years, and it's still not clear what is envisaged about the role of Chinese financial institutions, besides the Bank of China itself, internationally. And if China envisages a much more dynamic role and the acquisition of foreign assets, which are besides treasury bonds, for instance, the consequences of such initiatives are going to be very, very complex, as we have seen when the Chinese tried to buy an American petroleum company and a number of the other acquisitions the Chinese have tried to undertake. So I've generally tried to stay away from the business of prophecy, and hence I've not really speculated very much about the role of the Chinese. But you're absolutely right; they are the elephant in the room, and one can't think of East Asia changing without a significant role for China.
Thank you. Next one down here.
Thank you for the lecture. Stephen Perry, 48 Group Club. Sorry you're not too keen on prophecy, but I want to mention another word which hasn't been mentioned so far, apart from China, which is Kuala Lumpur. Next month, ASEAN, China, India, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, meeting with their heads of state, and I would think that signifies a very important decision about most of the East Asian countries about where their priority lies for the foreseeable future, and the emergence probably of a East Asian Union similar to the European Union, perhaps without the political unification. In the light of what you've been saying about the past, are they short-sighted and unable to see the crises, or do they have a perception of a future for themselves that's perhaps based on learning from those mistakes, and in fact is the basis really for Western business to concern itself with? That is the dynamic of the East Asian Union.
In the written text, which will be available on the website as soon as I can get somebody to help me with retyping the text, but I do have a written text where I do talk about the APEC, the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, which I do think has is really not going to be very significant in the future, because of the it has not been terribly significant since the second Clinton administration, and it has really lost its previous focus on economic cooperation, and it's now increasingly engaging, but only in a perfunctory way in a number of other issues, security issues, and so on and so forth. Now, what will happen with this East Asian summit in Kuala Lumpur remains to be seen. As you remember, it was Prime Minister Mahathir who was the strong advocate of this. And in fact, if you go back far enough, it was at the end. It was at the failure of the Uruguay round of trade negotiations under GATT to come to some agreement in Brussels in I think it was in December 1989 when he first suggested an East Asian economic grouping. Now the current leadership of the Malaysian government are perhaps a little less strongly committed to that kind of East Asian cooperation. Secondly, there has been a much more ambiguous role, particularly on the part of the Australian government, as far as East Asian cooperation is concerned. And this has been especially true of Mr. Howard's government, but it has also been true of Labour governments in the past. If you remember, the original APEC cooperation arrangements were to involve East Asia, and the Australians were invited to participate, but it was the Australians who then chose to refer to Washington for approval. And when Washington was consulted, it insisted on becoming involved. So the original East Asian proposal of the late 1980s became a Pacific Rim proposal in the form of APEC, first under the first Bush administration, and subsequently consolidated during the first Clinton administration. Now, what is going to happen now is, of course, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. And I think a likely scenario is to consolidate not only the financial arrangements which I described earlier, but also cooperation on trade front. But this kind of cooperation on the trade front need not necessarily involve a preferential trade area, but rather it could involve other types of cooperation as far as trading is concerned, which will encourage greater trade within the Asian region. Now, if this is achieved, it will obviously create the conditions for further cooperation within the region. But much will depend on the willingness of Canberra, and to a lesser extent of Tokyo, to see its interests as residing in greater regional cooperation.
I think I'll take two more since time is marching on. There's somebody in the second row up there.
David, it was very much on
APEC. So okay. Yeah, you okay? Thanks. There's one down here then, thanks. And if there's another one, we'll take one more. Can I see? Yeah, okay, you got in first. Thanks. Go ahead.
My name is Roger Samuels. I'm a writer, and I was very interested to hear your talk. Thank you very much for the information. What I wanted to do was to say how absolutely amazed I was to hear your percentages about the speculative flow of capital around the world being 3% of the real economy and the rest was speculation. And I wanted to know if you could tell us whether it's purely the rate of interest that moves the capital, and if so, whether there can be some organizational arrangements to regulate interest rates to stop that flow. And secondly, where does the money go? Does it simply go on deposit at a bank, or does it enter the economy? Because if it enters the economy, it causes severe disruption in the ability to manage that economy internally, obviously. Are you able to answer those questions, please?
I suspect our chairman tonight might be better able to answer those questions than I am. Having presided over the Financial Services Authority, he is singularly well placed to because we are talking about a whole range of financial services which have developed and very they have mutated in very, very interesting ways. And with very important consequences. And to some extent, there is some regional variation in the many of the activities which go on here or in Wall Street, for example, are different from the kinds of activities which you would find in, say, in Tokyo or in Frankfurt. The broad range I do think they would require special careful attention. But I think the whole question as to whether interest rates do matter, yes, interest rates do matter, and we are currently in a very exceptional situation right now of having had relatively low interest rates, not only nominal interest rates, but also low real interest rates. And this is a promise from international financial liberalization, which had previously been unrealized, but has now come to pass in the recent period, although I suspect that this will be temporary and we will see a situation of interest rates continuing to rise, albeit very slowly. But yes, interest rates still do matter. And but what we often find in many countries now, with a big emphasis on central bank independence, is a situation where governments are often have less authority over monetary policy generally, including interest rate setting, than they previously had.
Last question on the front row up here.
Yeah, hi. Just a general question. Joe Chan from the Economics Department of ALC. Just a general question about policy making. You mentioned that regional trade agreements and regionalism should be encouraged around the world, and especially for the case of East Asia. I just want to know, if do you think it's going to be a complementary towards multilateralism, and this, if there's any prospect of international world trade talks to be of any success in the future, especially in the Hong Kong ministerial, which is coming up in December. Just in summary, do you think regionalism could be a complement to multilateralism?
Okay, there are two parts of that question which I'll try to put to separate, because I do think they need to be separated. I don't see regionalism as particularly desirable in and of itself. I do feel, however, that in the current world situation, with the reluctance to reform at the international level, often it is possible to undertake initiatives at the regional level which will contribute to the reform effort and would at least constitute a second best option. And that's my main case for regionalism. The other reason why I do favor regional cooperation is that given the decline of national political national sovereignty in a whole range of economic areas, it is precisely through regionalism that there is the possibility of indirectly exercising national authority and ensuring that economic processes continue to serve developmental and other ends. Now, as far as the Doha round is concerned, I must admit that I'm increasingly of the view that there is very little which is developmental about the Doha round. Much of the negotiation is not over. It in fact negates the likelihood that a trade policy can be developmental. Mr. Johnson, Alan Johnson, in a very remarkable speech last month at the Foreign Policy Center in London, talked about, I think it was called the Wall of Shame, and he talked about what would be desirable stance, not only for the UK, but also for Europe. He took the view that while reducing agricultural subsidies and tariffs in the north, he would also not want to force trade liberalization on developing countries. This was the stance of Mr. Johnson. Unfortunately, less than a week later, Mr. Mandelson took a completely different view in outlining the European position for negotiations before Hong Kong. So while I do not expect a significant breakthrough in Hong Kong, I'm sure something will be cobbled together. This is the nature of such meetings, that you need to come up with something. But I think any likelihood that the outcome will be significantly developmental is dubious. And very importantly, I think the main thing which is held out to be developmental is said to be the agricultural trade liberalization. And if one looks at this very carefully, the main gainers from agricultural trade liberalization will be North America, the US and Canada, Australasia, Australia and New Zealand, Southeast Asia, my own country, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, and the southern cone of Latin America, Brazil, Argentina, and Chile. It is very unlikely that the poorest countries in the world, especially those in Africa, are going to gain very much. This is very clear from computable general equilibrium models and all types of other modeling and estimates which have been done on the likely benefits from agricultural trade liberalization. So I must say that I'm not terribly enthusiastic about the likely outcomes from the Hong Kong interministerial next month.
Thank you. I hope you weren't surprised that two senior members of the Labour Party should take different views, because if you were, you have something to learn about British politics. But I think we have learned a huge amount from you on the way the UN sees things, but also, of course, yourself, and you've carefully distinguished between the UN and your own analysis. It was a fascinating tour d'horizon about a riveting period in East Asian history, and although you said you weren't a forecaster, I think you have given us a lot of thoughts about how things will develop in the future. Very relevant to many of the students here who are doing courses in areas which abut your interests, but also relevant to Standard Chartered, who have managed to run their business through these exciting, turbulent periods, and no doubt will continue to do so. Thank you very much, and particularly for answering the questions so frankly and so fully. We're delighted to have you here. We can now give you a drink and something to eat. And thank you all for coming.